On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Do objects have their own presence? Or can an object be sacred or holy? Can an object be important to us because of things that we have suffered? And if so, how do we understand the significance of those things? We're here today to talk to Dr. Laura Levitt, who is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University, the author of American Jewish Lost After the Holocaust, and Jews and Feminism, The Ambivalent Search for Home, and her newest book, The Objects That Remain, from Penn State University Press. Laura, thank you very much for making time to talk to us today on The Bookshelf.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
The place to start is the place that the book starts, and that is with something terrible that happened to you while you were in graduate school at Emory University. Obviously, this is an event that changed the course of your life in more than one way.
Yes, exactly. So this was in November of 1989. I was a doctoral student at Emory University, as you noted. I was actually studying Jewish and Christian theology, of all things. I was at home in my apartment in Midtown Atlanta, and I heard a funny sound. I was watching television. I think I was exercising in the living room. And you know how you walk through the house because you hear something, and you pull the curtains back in the bathroom. And I did those things, and then I walked my bedroom, and I looked around. I didn't see anything. And as I was turning, a strange man jumped out of the closet. You know, it was like something out of a really bad movie, something that you don't imagine would ever happen to you, but there it was. This man attacked me. He tried to choke me, and eventually he raped me. And that's the beginning of this story, and it did change my life in many ways. And I will say, part of what I tried to do in the book is, this is a heavy subject, but I have to say that my experience is both of that initial nightmare, but also of a really quite profound and very long-lasting euphoria that came because I lived,
right?
That I didn't die that night, and I got to do the things that I so love doing. You know, when this man was choking me, I thought, oh my God, I just found my voice. I was falling in love with the work that I was doing, and I was like, I can't die. I want to be a professor. I want to write books. I want to teach people. I want to be a writer. And I've gotten to do those things, and this is something that I also want people to understand as a part of that, of this experience.
Part of the story is the discovery years later that the things that were taken from you as evidence, pair of sweatpants that you were wearing at the time, and other things like that, sheets and so forth, that they apparently had never particularly been processed, and it was considered not just a cold case, but apparently never got investigated much beyond the initial report that you made to the police and their subsequent interview with you and the gathering of some physical evidence. And that's as far as it ever got, which had to be an enormously frustrating thing for you, because our concept of justice is that eventually the people that do bad things get caught because they're foolish or because they're careless or because the police are brilliant and they have the right evidence with the right chain of ownership and everything, and everything works out. And that was not your case.
No, that was not my case. And it's not, unfortunately, the case of so many Americans, although I think we grow up in a culture where we have these assumptions. And part of it is that, you know I grew up with after-school specials and police procedurals, all those legal cases, and it just seemed like everything was always resolved in a courtroom.
Right.
And I just assumed that that was the way it was going to be. And so one of the things that I lost that night was my faith in that process as something that was going to be available to me or available to most of us. And it was a rather shocking experience. So I will say that my discovery of this is that, you know, I called the police. The police came to my home that night. They did take evidence. And then they had me go to Grady Memorial Hospital, which was one of the places where they did rape exams. That's where they take physical evidence from your person, right, from your body.
Mm-hmm.
And those are a part of what's called a rape kit. They are supposed to be processed, of course, for evidence. And in my case, what I discovered really quite belatedly was, as you note, one, they couldn't find the evidence that was taken. I made a formal request to the Atlanta police only in 2014. And because when I began the book, I thought, well, you know, I was kind of afraid to go there. And I had kind of prepared myself by saying, of course, there'd be a final chapter called Nothing Left. And that was not exactly the case because, as you note, I did get access to my case file. And what that case file revealed was both that some things had been taken into custody, of course, and there was my statement. But what I didn't even actually take in, because I found the document so jarring, was the fact that there was a note inside that file to a certain kind of report that said that the case was opened in November of 1989 after I had been raped, and that in January of 1990, they had decided that there was nothing else to do, and that's when clearly everything stopped. But in my request to get the evidence, they could never find it. And there's no documentation that says that the rape kit was ever processed. And I should say that my case in this regard is very similar to so many, many, many cases across the United States, not just in Atlanta. Rape kits are notoriously under-processed in the United States. In fact, the star of the TV show Special Victims Unit is one of the, in the weirdness of the way life works, this actress has become one of the major spokespeople in trying to get those rape kits processed and has raised private funds to do that. And although I completely applaud her efforts, this should not be the work of an actress and voluntary contributions. This should be a part of the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
So that's a big challenge, and it's one of the things that the book tries to elucidate and make suggestions about why it is the case that this work is so invisible, that we don't understand how crucial this is to the law working, right?
Once I read the entirety of the book, I understood where the flow was going. But at first, when I started reading it, I thought, oh, we're talking about this, and now we're going to talk about something that seems to be unrelated to it. And that's what made it interesting, because I thought, okay, I know there's a chain of custody in this, too. So I will follow this and try to figure out what it is that the author is trying to say to me. So I'm going to say the next thing about the book that I found very interesting is that you got involved with the International Association for Property and Evidence and participated in a class along with 40 law enforcement officials in 2009 to learn more about this chain of custody and how evidence is collected by crime scene investigators and so forth. If what we're relying on to get our information in the world is television shows, particularly fictional television shows, then we're going to be sorely disappointed when we discover that life is seldom as cut and dried, either legally or physically, as they are on television shows. The proliferation of CSI in over the last 20 years has kind of made people think, oh, well, there's scientists. There's an army of scientists across America that are doing these incredible things, and boom, they're catching the bad guys. And would it be, about the same time as you were taking this class, I learned that a longtime friend of mine had also been sexually assaulted because she started talking about it on her Facebook page and saying that we desperately need to get these rape kits. There's a huge backlog of rape kits that have yet to be processed. I must admit that I couldn't help but think about all of these labs that are doing the ancestry research, right? Send in your thing and you can find it if you're partially Irish or whatever. And I thought, couldn't those guys be doing that? You know, couldn't they be doing those rape kits if somebody was paying them to do those kits? And once again, why shouldn't it be criminal justice? Is that part of why you decided to get involved with the IAPE to learn more about, because now you have a personal emotional investment in the idea that they could find the bad guys?
Well, yes. I mean, of course I have a personal investment, but I also, I genuinely became interested because I, in fact, the part of the motivation for this book or part of the inspiration was learning about the murder of another woman and a very old cold case that came back to life because there was DNA evidence. And in learning about that story, I learned that the police had this woman's clothing from almost 40 years earlier, right? What she was wearing the night that she was murdered.
Right.
And that really intrigued me, and partially because I think in a kind of associative way, that's not particularly linear, but I was working on Holocaust memory, and so I was keenly aware of all of the kinds of artifacts that are held in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So I was thinking about these things together and was curious about this. And I really genuinely wanted to understand what the police do. And I didn't understand the laws. Like, how long do they keep this stuff, you know, and who has access, and how does it work? And so I went to do research, and in the process of doing research, I thought I was asking a legal question, and I was told, no, this is not a legal matter. I was actually at Harvard Law Library asking these questions, and the law librarian was like, no, I'm sorry, this is not a legal question. But in the process, I found this international organization, and I was able to talk to its founder and president. And so I joined the organization, and I started reading their materials, and they hold these classes, really, for property managers who work in all kinds of, and remember, these are decentralized, so every precinct has a property room. So I was able to take a course and learn what they do. And it was a fascinating and compelling experience. In part, and my admiration for this organization is great, because what they're trying to do is professionalize these practices. You know, going back to television, which is how so many of us know these things, right?
Right.
If you watch a show like The Wire, you know that when a cop gets into trouble, they get grounded. And if you're really bad, they send you to the property room. So that nice guy in The Wire starts making little furniture because he's sitting there in the evidence room. And yet what I wanted to argue, and I do argue, is that the evidence room is crucial. There can be no legal case unless they actually have evidence. And that evidence has to be kept so that it is viable to go to court. So you can't just, like, put it in a bag and, you know, throw it in a closet. It has to be in a temperature-controlled room, especially if you have DNA. You don't want to put blood in a plastic bag because that would deteriorate the sample. So there are all kinds of things that need to be attended to. And so I became very interested in those practices, and I write about them as both an art and in some ways a kind of ritual, a kind of rite that these officers perform. And I really wanted to do justice, if you will, to the work that they do, because without them there would be no criminal justice system, and yet they are completely invisible to most of us most of the time.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Laura Levitt, who is the author of The Objects That Remain from Penn State University Press. She is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University. The transition is made in the book between the idea of justice, the idea of physical things that are related to this chain of custody, and the people that are entrusted with them, with maintaining them, with archiving them, with keeping them safe. And transition is made philosophically and emotionally to the Holocaust. And I found this a topic that really touches me very deeply. I am not of Jewish ancestry, but I am a Christian, and I know that the Christians have a terrible history. The church has had a terrible history through the centuries in dealing with Jews, and that the Holocaust was carried out by many people who considered themselves Christian. I do not consider themselves Christian, because I don't think you can injure the people of God and still consider yourself a Christian. Mm-hmm. I have had the opportunity to go to museums, but I also went to Auschwitz and spent a day there. What you're talking about in the archiving and the preservation of the objects that are kept in Holocaust museums and in places like Auschwitz reminded me of some of the things that deeply touched me as I was touring this horror of a museum.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the sort of presence of the place, the physical place, and those objects that were there then and are here now is a way in which we connect to the past, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes it palpable. And I think that this is especially the case in the present moment, as so many survivors are aging and becoming frail, and many of them are dying.
Right.
So the material objects are some of the traces that we have that connect us in that kind of palpable way to then and there in the present, in this place.
You talk about things like that that have been shaped by human beings who have worn them or carried them as taking on a different kind of presence than just something that you go to Walmart and buy. As I was walking through the different buildings and they were showing us these huge collections of things that Jews had brought with them, having been told, bring your nicest clothes, wear your nicest shoes, because you're going to be processed and then you'll be sent to a place to live. An example of how barbaric the Nazis really were is that they actually stole from the Jews in order to continue to murder them. The depth of that depravity is almost incomprehensible to me. But I think the exhibit that really tore my heart out was a room full of shoes for children and babies, because I have grandchildren now that are small. And even talking about it now, I fight for control, that it moved me so deeply to think of these babies that were at the beginning of their life and they would never get to see, and they would never grow up because of what these men did there.
I think that what you describe and the way that you describe it captures well the ways in which calling those rescued objects at places like the Holocaust Museum or at sites of commemoration at Auschwitz and at some of the other camps, calling them simply evidence doesn't begin to get at the kind of affective register, the kinds of feelings and emotions that these objects convey. And so part of what I wanted to do in the book, and this is part of my way of talking about the objects as sacred or holy, is that because we pay attention to them and understand, you know, what they mean and what they help us get a grasp of, we are engaged in a kind of process that animates them, that keeps them alive, and in some ways out of our control. And this is some of the ways in which, towards the end of the book, I really talk in much more explicitly religious language about these objects, that we don't have full control over them, right? They may be empirical evidence that a historian might use to make an argument and to build a book, or they may be used in a court case as physical evidence, but they are also something else. And so they invite us to ask questions, to imagine what they might have meant to the people who wore them. They give us kind of an access to these other qualities and these other stories. And so for me, doing justice is about recognizing the ways in which we don't control those objects, but that we help animate them by bringing our gifts. If you're an artist or a writer or musician, I talk about the work of some photographers and other artists throughout the book.
Yes.
But these are all people who are, like the people who are attending to the objects in storage, are also granting them kind of tender regard. And that tender regard is what makes them holy.
There's a phrase that you have in the book, touching the past is implicit in the act of holding. And holding signals the relationship between objects and memory. Even in completely benign situations, a shirt that my dad, who's been gone these 10 years, but he and I are the same size, and so when I wear his shirt, I am reminded of the way his body fit in the shirt and how the shirt was shaped by his wearing it before I wore it and changed the shape of it because I'm not exactly the same shape as my dad. This is a very real thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm listening to your story and I'm thinking, I'm sitting here, I'm wearing a ring that belonged to my mother who died 9 years ago.
Yeah.
I try to have something of her with me all the time, right?
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
palpable object, I mean, I have her in my memory, but having something physical is, we talk about a touchstone, right? But
right.
we literally mean that in the ways in which you just described your father's shirt.
Yeah. These things take on a presence, and they were shaped by people. They were touched by people. Whether we're looking at the sweater that you talk about in the book that was worn by a girl who had practically nothing else to wear for years while she was in hiding from the Nazis, that this is not just something that you buy at a yard sale anymore. This is no longer just another piece of clothing. This has a history to it, and it has a relationship to a human being that once was part of it. And I suppose that's really what makes things like that different than, say, even a car that somebody drove or something like that. And even though this kind of objects can have this same sort of relationship, I'm driving a truck that was my late father-in-law's, and both of my sons keep trying to buy it from me. And I tell them, no, I'm not going to let you drive a truck that has no airbags or anything like that. Why do you want it? And they said, because granddaddy drove.
So, yes, exactly. And as you were talking about this, I was thinking there's a scholar named Oren Steer who teaches at Florida International University, and he's written about what he calls Holocaust icons. And so he writes about railroad cars, right, that are in Holocaust museums.
Right.
And so sometimes those objects can be very large, or at the Holocaust Museum, they have a barrack from one of the camps. And I write about how the museum was built around one of those that was on long-term loan, and eventually the Polish government wanted it returned. And so the museum had to find another barrack and then retrofit it into the museum, so that even sometimes very large objects, certainly when we're talking about something like the Holocaust, can be also quite compelling. You know, there are people who find it sacred to... Because the railroad car was there then, and with those people in it, they don't want to step inside of it. And then for others, the sacred thing to do is to step inside of it. And so the museum allows you to choose which way you want to go. But I think it's in recognition of how we engage with objects, right? And we engage with the material presence of these very powerful objects.
I know our time is getting short, and there's still so much more this is a much more dense book than it looks like. It's not a very long book, but there's a great depth to it. And one of the things that I wanted to say to you is that through all of that you suffered, the search for justice and everything, this changed your look toward the very subject that you were studying when this attack occurred. But I love what you say here. Looking at sacred objects, and especially processing the prose of Nelson, Duvall, and Detective Schroeder, I have learned to live without certainty, but I cannot live without wonder. I think that is the beginning of a religious sort of experience, too, that for me, wonder is an inherent part of following a transcendent God. And you and I may not agree on those particulars there, but I think that we're in the same kind of way of thinking, that we can't live without wonder. And that's what makes life livable.
I actually quite agree with you on this point. And the way in which we may approach what that wonder means or what it looks like is, of course, informed by the traditions that form us mm-hmm. and that continue to resonate for us. But I have to say that I really found that this book became a much more religious book. I didn't expect to go there, but part of the wonder of writing this book, and it's connected to the kind of strange juxtapositions of different kinds of stories.
Right.
Is that along the way, over and over again, I would find myself talking to the right person at the right time. Some people think about that as serendipity, but I think about it as wonder,
yeah.
And it's that which we don't control. I write about this Sergeant Schroeder in the case of this other woman's murder,
mm-hmm.
And he says that, you know, in following this case, as he was working the case, it wasn't just him doing it. that he was there with, as he says, the hand of God.
Yeah.
And I love that this is, you know, an officer who is really doing the work, right?
Right.
And who I have oodles of respect for. And for him to have the humility to say that and to recognize what he doesn't control is a very powerful and a very beautiful way of thinking. Because the problem with certitude and the problem with that kind of logic is for people who've been victimized, it's often comes out of a desire for control. Like, we want to know, if I'd only done this, if I'd only shut the door again, if I'd only run out the front of the house the first time I heard a funny sound,
right,
this wouldn't have happened. But what that amounts to is a kind of self-blaming or right, victim blaming, right?
Yeah.
And I know the allure of that. It's so tempting because we want control. And yet what I've really come to is that kind of control is really destructive.
Right.
And instead we have to understand and appreciate that which we don't control.
I think letting go of control is one of the most difficult things that humans ever have to do. And yet I think it's absolutely vital for us to survive in the world, to not pull on ourselves the blame for everything that doesn't go the way we wanted it to, whether it's a big thing and a big terrible thing or just ordinary things, to realize that we're not in control of everything and it's just as well. And I would also say that through your book, that what I am reminded of is that in life there is restoration and there is redemption, and I realize those are often thought of as Christian terms, and they certainly are, but I also think that they are Hebrew Testament terms, too. The God of what we call the Old Testament is a God of redemption and restoration in a very deep sense, too.
I mean, I think that one of the things that my book tries to, well, and ends up enacting is the ways in which we learn from each other, so
yes,
that I learned a great deal about the ways in which objects can be holy from scholars who engage with relics.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned a great deal from Christian traditions, particularly Catholic traditions, of relics and their containers and mm-hmm, how relics proliferate. So everything that touches the relic is imbibed with some of the holiness of the relic and takes on a kind of, it becomes a relic in and of itself.
Yes.
And you know, these were surprising places that I went to, but I think that part of what I hope the book enacts and what it presents is that we have so much to learn with and from each other, right?
Right.
And from our different traditions. And that was both a delight and a surprise and also incredibly moving because these were not categories that I was familiar with before I started on this project.
Well, it is a fascinating book and an incredible journey that you take us along. And there's so much imagery in the book, and we could talk another half an hour easily about it, is deep. I would encourage people to get a copy and read for themselves. And particularly, if there are places in here that make you think in new ways, that is the great wonder of reading, isn't it? That we can, like you say, we enter into a contract with the people who write, who want to present a new way of looking at things, and it becomes not a monologue, but a dialogue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Laura, I know the book is available on online and I'm sure on websites. I'm sure people go to Penn State University Press's website that they can find a copy of it. Are there any other websites that you would encourage them to see?
Sure. You can go to my website. I have a new one. It's called Laura Levitt, LauraLevitt. .org, and you'll find lots more information about the book, but Penn State is a great place to go to buy the book. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking time to share with us.
Thank you, Doc. I really appreciate your thoughtful questions, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Our thanks again to Dr. Laura Levitt, the author of The Objects That Remain, Penn State University Press. You can check out her website, lauralevitt.org. We'll see you next Sunday right here on your favorite radio stations. Listen also on my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.